Hello, and welcome to another fine episode of Data Book.
This is a podcast produced by our magazine, Healthcare Analytics News. That's hcanews.com.
And I am your host, Jack Murtha.
And I'm your co-host, Tom Castles.
So before we get started, if you like Databook, please remember to rate, subscribe, and review it on your favorite podcasting app.
And speaking of apps, please let us know which healthcare apps you use and love every day.
And tell us on Twitter, at @HCA_news.
Give us a good one, and we'll write about it.
So today on Databook, we are bringing you the story of a cold-blooded killer.
He's a serial killer and a rapist with a knack for burglary.
And a chilling body count.
Yet somehow, this story jumps into health tech and the ethics of groundbreaking innovations.
Somehow, this story grows to become something more than just the lives that were ruined by this monster. Somehow, this becomes a story of our values, of where our society is headed. For today's story, we're going way back to February 2nd, 1978. It's just after 9 p.m.
There's a young couple, Brian and Katie Maggiore, who are taking their dog for a walk. They're in a sleepy, middle-class neighborhood in this town called Rancho Cordova. That's a suburb of Sacramento, California.
So Brian is 21 years old, and he's in the Air Force. Katie is only 20. They're young, they're married, they're happy.
But what they don't know yet is that they're in big trouble.
So they're walking past porch lights and some light posts, but it's a really dark night.
You gotta imagine that it's really creepy because a bunch of burglaries and even some sexual assaults have been going on in this very neighborhood that they're walking through.
People are talking about this stuff. They know what's going on and they're afraid. They know that someone's out there, some sort of boogeyman.
So Brian and Katie are trudging along when all of a sudden they encounter this guy.
And we're not totally sure how this goes down, but this guy who they encounter, well, it becomes pretty clear that this is the boogeyman who everyone fears.
So right away, they get into some kind of foot chase or fight. There's a lot of commotion, and the three of them end up in their neighbor's backyard.
This bad guy is after them, and Katie and Brian are trying to run away. So they're in this neighbor's backyard, and they don't know where to go. They see a broken part of the fence, and they speed toward it.
Meanwhile, the owner of the house, of the backyard that they're in, is watching through his window. He's watching all of this go down, and he sees the man who's chasing Brian and Katie raise a gun and fire at them as they try to escape.
Then the attacker runs into the neighbor's yard and fires toward the ground. But the witness, watching from his house, he can't see if this guy actually shot anyone.
As quick as he entered the backyard, the shooter bolts right out of there.
And some other neighbors catch a glimpse of him. He's wearing a black or blue ski mask, and he's holding a handgun.
There are some more gunshots that go off, and then this guy just runs into the bushes.
And with that, he vanishes into the dark unknown.
So cops and EMS workers come for Brian and Katie Maggiore. They take them to nearby hospitals as quick as they can.
But it's no use. Brian and Katie die. They die from the gunshot wounds that they sustained during this terrifying attack.
And as it turns out, Brian and Katie become the first murder victims of the Golden State Killer.
He's also been called the East Bay Rapist, the original Night Stalker.
And by now, you've probably heard some of his story. But just to catch you up, cops say he murdered 12 people and raped, this is really disgusting, more than 50 women.
And God knows how many burglaries this guy committed.
Over the course of 12 years from the mid-70s to mid-80s, the Golden State Killer caused chaos in quiet middle-class neighborhoods in California.
The areas he prowled were just gripped with fear. Neighbors in some areas even slept in shifts sometimes. They were hoping to prevent an attack by looking out for each other.
But still, he stalked, he taunted, and he terrorized.
And for more than 30 years, the Golden State Killer got away with it. That is, until this spring.
That's when police decided to run his DNA on an open source genealogy website, and they got a lead.
So before you know it, they had charged a suspect. His name, Joseph James D'Angelo, a 72-year-old former cop.
So why is Databook interested in this story?
It's all about the DNA, the data. You see, the Golden State Killer case was solved in a way that was totally unique and novel and only possible in today's high-tech, data-driven world. But it raised some really big questions.
Mm-hmm. the late 70s and 80s, the Golden State Killer was the man behind California's real-life nightmares.
Now, we told you he was a creep and a dangerous creep, but we're gonna back that up with some supporting evidence beyond the murder.
If you read his arrest warrant, you can get a really good idea of just how heinous he truly was. Take this rundown of events from the weeks leading up to the murders of Brian and Katie Maggiore.
So in the days and weeks before that tragedy, the killer targeted 12 homes in a radius that spanned just a third of a mile.
Women reported nightly hang-up phone calls, and others reported prowler activity.
Homes had been burglarized. I mean, in one break-in, a woman's underwear was stolen.
Fence gates and the doors of houses were opened, and people saw it. Shoe prints were found outside of some women's bedrooms.
And in several cases, women found taunting drawings on their bedroom windows, and it looked like these drawings were made with bodily fluids.
So 3 nights before these murders, a 20-something was the victim of a nighttime burglary, but the intruder didn't take anything.
Can you imagine that? It was kind of just a display of power, just a break-in for the sake of a break-in. And even on the night of the murders, a woman reported an attempted burglary, but the suspect was luckily stopped by a special security device that she had placed on her sliding door.
And around 8 p.m. that same night, a woman reported a creepy hang-up call. She lived across the street from where Brian and Katie were killed.
So this was just the precursor stuff. And we really don't want to dive into the details of the many despicable rapes and sexual and physical assaults committed by the Golden State Killer, because it's just, well, it's too much.
I think at this point you get the idea. The guy was cold, he was persistent, and he was brutal.
And for a long time, he was free. In the past decade, the world has seen a meteoric rise in direct-to-consumer genetic testing. You've probably heard of them, 23andMe, Ancestry.com. They've become household names thanks to their at-home DNA tests.
These tests give consumers insights on a bunch of things. Disease risk, lineage, even what your superhero power might be.
And it hasn't always been an easy road. The FDA has stepped in when it came to direct-to-consumer medical tests. It wasn't even until this year that companies could legally scan for disease risk.
But this has quickly become a huge market with really, really big growth potential.
And the market has sparked secondary services, like the website GEDmatch.
The problem with these DNA ancestry services is that they're closed off. That means customers of one company can't compare their DNA to the database of another.
So GEDmatch solves that problem because it allows users to upload their raw DNA files to a digital open source database.
This is where our story gets controversial.
So in 1996, police were investigating a whole bunch of murders that occurred in the 1980s, late 70s, and they zeroed in on one from 1980. All of these murders appeared to be the work of the Golden State Killer.
But back in the 80s, DNA technology just wasn't that great. But then, by the mid-90s, it had really evolved.
So these detectives take a swab of DNA collected from the murder scene of this 1980 crime. And they develop a DNA profile. And then these detectives do this again and again, year after year, case after case, using DNA from other Golden State Killer crime scenes.
And they find that the profiles match.
But the DNA profiles don't lead to any suspects, just more dead ends.
Until, that is, early 2018.
That's this year, and it is when police went to GEDmatch.
An enterprising detective uploaded the Golden State Killer's DNA profile. After 30 years, it was worth a shot, right?
Sure. And the thing is, the cops strike gold here.
The killer's DNA is a partial match with DNA that a user had uploaded onto GEDmatch.
Now, to be clear, the suspect never put his genetic data online.
Rather, this partial match belonged to a relative.
So the cops do some more digging after they get this match, and they ultimately identify Joseph James D'Angelo as a potential suspect.
In mid-April, police swipe a DNA sample from his car door handle while he's shopping inside a Hobby Lobby.
So this sample contains DNA from 3 different people, but an expert isolates one guy's DNA, and it looks like a match.
A few days later, police go to D'Angelo's home during the night. They take some of his garbage from a trash can, and they find a tissue.
Now this DNA sample, this is pretty much a direct hit. D'Angelo must be their guy.
The next day, 72-year-old D'Angelo is finally arrested. And along with other crimes, he's charged with the murders of Brian and Katie Maggiore.
So almost immediately, national news outlets jump on this story.
Obviously, it's a big deal. The Golden State Killer was vicious. He haunted the California suburbs, and he got away with it.
Until now. Finally, it seemed, the families of Brian and Katie and so many other victims, they might see some justice.
But at the same time as this is all coming to a head, the public conversation begins to absolutely explode. And it took another turn.
Writers, thinkers, just everyday people, they were all really intrigued by how police identified the suspect.
It was the first time we ever saw law enforcement use a DNA-driven genealogy site in such a way. And it raised a bunch of legal and ethical questions.
See, a lot of people saw this as an overstep. Is this really what customers were signing up for when they sent their DNA to these companies? And did these customers even understand that their data might be used in this way?
Did patients really understand that by taking genetic tests for medical risks, that they might be surrendering their DNA, their family members' DNA, over to police?
But on the other hand, many people saw this as a valuable new tool for detectives. I mean, it had resulted in the arrest of an alleged serial killer and rapist.
With that in mind, how could cops using these DNA databases be anything but good?
So late last month, experts from the National Institutes of Health published a commentary on this very issue.
They were inspired by the debate stemming from the Golden State Killer case. And they set out to analyze the ethical hazards of solving crimes with commercial genealogy data.
So Dr. Christine Grady is one of the authors of that report. She is the chief of the NIH Clinical Center's Department of Bioethics and a leading expert in this really tricky field.
And she's joined us on Databook today to discuss this very tricky situation.
So Dr. Grady, welcome to Databook.
Wonderful to be here.
Your commentary asks if it's ethical to use genealogy data to solve crimes. What's your answer?
My answer is yes, under certain conditions. So it's an amazing tool that can be used in certain ways to help solve crimes. And I think my own view is that it should be able to be used in that way. But there are lots of things that the public doesn't recognize about how genealogy databases are being used for crime solving. And so we need more education, we need better informed consent, we need some more standards at the level of the crime labs that are using it and the police departments that are using it.
When we talk about the ethics of this new technology, what are the biggest concerns?
I think many people, if not most people, who use genealogy databases don't actually appreciate the range of uses for those data. What that means is we need a better educated public about, you know, how DNA, what DNA is, how it might be used, how if you sign up for a database to understand your ancestry or to find relatives or whatever, that there may be other uses for those data that you should be aware of and okay with. That's one thing. The second thing is that I think people might not appreciate that DNA is a very, very important and useful tool in a lot of ways, but it's not definitive. So, for example, in the description that we had about this particular case, DNA evidence that there was something at the site that might have belonged to this person doesn't necessarily translate into the person was even there, first of all, but secondly, that they were the person who committed the crime. And so there needs to be a sort of humility, if that's the right way to think about it, about the role of DNA as evidence in cases like this one and others of this nature. And then the third thing, and we talked about this in the paper, you know, we are aware that databases are comprised of different groups of people. And so understanding who's in the database and how that might be used inappropriately to target specific kinds of groups that shouldn't be targeted in these cases. So issues of justice, issues of privacy, and issues of informed consent, I think, are the three major issues that need to be thought through and attended to if we use this as a tool for solving crimes.
What about responsibility and consent? How should we, as a society, distribute this level of responsibility among genetic testing companies, their customers, and law enforcement? Who is responsible?
I think all of the above. It's a very important but challenging issue, and that is, how do we assure that people, the public, those of us who are using these wonderful services, how do we assure that we know what we're getting into when we use them? I mean, it's true across all kinds of, you know, new technology and interesting opportunities that are available to us. Unfortunately, as you, I'm sure, are aware, you know, most of us, when we get on a computer or if we buy a new tool or device, there are agreements that we check the box and say we agree to. There are data that show that very, very few people read those. And so that is not the solution, is to make those longer or more complete, because I don't think people will get the information from that in the way that they should. It should be there, but we can't rely on that as the only way that people get information, which is why I said earlier, and I think one of the things we should be aware of sort of in general is public education. All of us who are users of new technology need to understand better than we do the range of uses for technology, the range of uses for information that we provide in so many different ways in our lives. And if those things need to be curtailed, that should be a public decision.
Dr. Grady, let's talk a little bit about distinctions that exist between consent for biomedical research and forensics.
The research methodologies that are available today, which are very powerful and can do wonderful things using big data, require sort of thinking a new way about consent. So here's what I mean by that. In the sort of traditional paradigm of how we do research, we might enroll 1,000 people and be able to talk to each one of them as they enroll and collect data from them that we then use for research purposes. Today, because of big data, we can use data sets that are already available, some of them public, some of them collected in research facilities, some of them collected in clinical facilities, and put together data from a variety of sources where we can learn things that are very useful for health and medical care, but using data from millions of people. The interesting challenge there is, do those millions of people know we're using their data for these purposes? And the answer is probably, in many cases, no. So the challenge in research is in some ways different from what we're talking about in terms of forensic uses of genealogy databases, and in other ways it's quite similar. What we've talked about in research circles is something that people call broad consent, although there are other terms for it. But the idea of broad consent is, when you're collecting data from somebody today, you can ask them, we would like to use your data for research in the future. We can't even really describe to you what all that research might be, but here's a sort of flavor of what it might look like, and then get their consent in that way. And some institutions are already doing that. Most people, most members of the public, say yes to that. I suppose something like that idea could possibly be used in the sort of forensic space, but it's much trickier because, you know, when somebody is using a genealogy database, usually they're looking for ancestry information about their own family. Sometimes they're looking for missing relatives, or there are lots of uses of that nature. But rarely do people go into one of those databases because they think either, oh, I'm going to allow researchers to learn things that, you know, across databases that might be very useful for health or understanding health. Or, oh, I'm going to allow crime labs or police departments to be able to solve crimes that they might not be able to solve without my data because of who I'm related to all across my ancestry. So the process of getting consent for those things when somebody enters voluntarily into giving their data into a genealogy database is much more challenging.
Obviously, the Golden State Killer conversation is just on fire. Everybody is talking about this, and it's not just people in this space. What I want to know before you leave is, how should we as a society proceed? What is the best way to move this discussion forward?
I think there are multiple next steps which make sense to me. One of them is basically what you're doing, educating the public about what this is and why it's done and what are the limitations thereof, I think is a very important part of what needs to happen next. Secondly, I think law enforcement officials and policymakers should really think carefully about how this kind of data should be used in solving crimes and what the limitations of using it in solving crimes are. And there may be reasons to limit the kinds of cases it's used for. That's sort of above my pay grade, but I think that's something that at least that ought to be discussed. And then the third thing that ought to happen is that the databases that are offering their services to customers for ancestry kind of reasons need to make decisions about how they inform their customers, but also what criteria they're going to use about when to turn over data to somebody else, including law enforcement. They should make some decisions about how they're going to make their data available to other potential users, including forensics.
Dr. Christine Grady is the head of bioethics at the NIH's Clinical Center. Thanks for coming on Databook, Dr. Grady.
Thank you for inviting me. Great to talk to you.
So that's going to do it for this episode of Databook. Obviously, it wasn't the happiest one we've done yet, and it was anything but light. But we think this is a really important conversation, so we appreciate you for tuning in and Dr. Grady for joining us.
It may not be the happiest conversation we've ever had, but it could lead to really happy outcomes in the future. This is a really intriguing technology, and we're really glad that Dr. Grady was able to come on and shine some light on it for us.
Anyway, we will be back next week, as we always are, and we're going to talk to Gotham Thomas, who is a freelance writer for Healthcare Analytics News, our magazine, and he's going to discuss another really important topic, which is liability and artificial intelligence.
Specifically when it comes to liability in self-driving cars.
Because that's the only model that we have to go on right now. So anyway, please remember to rate, subscribe, and review this podcast if you like it. We are Databook, and we are available on all of your favorite podcasting apps.
Reach out to us on Twitter at @HCA_news, and come find me and Jack on Twitter, too. We're on there.
Yeah, I'm at Jack Murtha.
And I'm at @Thomas_Castles.
So also, check out our website, hcanews.com. We've got newsletters, we've got stories every day, stories big and small. And we also have an article about Dr. Grady and her colleagues' report.
We look forward to seeing you there and hearing your feedback.
So have a good one.
See you next week.